The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Charles Arthur. On the show this week,
I want to make it possible for you to whisper in someone's ear from 1,000 miles away. Any two people to talk with privacy as if they were standing face to face.
Chief executive and founder of Silent Circle, Phil Zimmerman, is one of the leading innovators in online encryption services. I'll be talking to the inventor of PGP about his new service and why crypto is good for business and freedom of speech.
Dear Yahoo, you've not just bought an online blogging service. You've bought an identity playground.
In her latest email from America, Alex Kotowski muses on the implications of Yahoo's recent $1 billion-plus purchase of blogging site Tumblr. Also, we'll have a tech news roundup for you, including news of Microsoft's new Xbox and Apple being the latest to come under fire over claims that it's avoiding billions of dollars in US taxes. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm here with Phil Zimmerman, who is the president and co-founder of Silent Circle, though in best sort of Troy McClure, in best Troy McClure fashion, you may know him better as the inventor of PGP, the email encryption system. Welcome, Phil. Let's go back actually to PGP, which you came up with. It's public key encryption. Pretty Good Privacy was the name, much easier shortened as PGP. And that was for email. Just a reminder, when did you actually devise that?
That was back in 1991.
Which is a fair while back. It's pretty much
when
the internet was run by dinosaurs.
But actually, back then in the dinosaur age, I wanted to do secure telephony, but there wasn't any technology infrastructure at that time to support it. So I had to content myself with secure email. So PGP was really kind of a detour for me on my way to what I really wanted to do, which was secure voice over IP or secure telephony, which these days is voice over IP.
I mean, in those days, they used to have secure phone lines, which were sort of rooted. You had hotlines between the White House and the Kremlin, which were sort of super secure and even scrambled, I think.
Yeah.
So there was scrambling of sorts in those days.
Sure.
But you were thinking more about the internet and the possibilities there, were you?
Yeah, I thought that it would be good to have secure telephony for millions of people.
Now, with PGP, you actually took the source code, and as I understand it, you were the person who uploaded it from a phone box somewhere in California when it looked as though the...
Well, I didn't upload it from a phone box. I gave it to a couple of my friends, and one of them uploaded it from a phone box, and another one just uploaded it from home.
Okay. And from there, that meant that the U.S. government's efforts at the time to prevent its export pretty much came to naught because it was on the internet, and it was one of the first examples where once it gets onto the internet, it's everywhere.
Well, that's right. At that time, that was from a bygone era where you had to explain yourself if you were using strong crypto. Why are you using strong crypto? Are you up to no good? What are you trying to hide? But these days, the legal environment has completely inverted from that. Now, if you don't use strong crypto, you have to explain yourself. If you're a doctor with patient records in the U.S., you have to comply with HIPAA, which requires you to encrypt your patient records. If you don't, you have to answer for that. If you leave a laptop in a taxi with 200,000 customer names on it, then you better hope it's encrypted, because if it's not, then you're going to have to tell all your customers and the public at large that what happened. And in fact, in Britain has laws about this too, maybe even stronger than we have in the U.S.
There are substantial fines for leaving that sort of data.
Yeah.
Yes.
So not only do you have to confess, you have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So the legal climate today for strong crypto is completely the opposite of what it was in the early 90s.
And PGP, having gone onto the internet, a fair number of people, I suppose, thought this means that because everyone will have access to strong cryptography for their email and for their hard drives, therefore everyone's going to start using it. And yet that didn't happen. So the technology's been there available as a sort of open source for people to implement. Various companies now sell PGP solutions, and there's a company which is called PGP Inc., which has changed owners a few times.
Well,
why do
that's
you think
right.
It, yeah,
now
why
it's in the hands of Symantec.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it is that people haven't taken up the idea of encrypting their email?
Well, I think one reason for that is that there is some complexity in the management of keys, and you have to know too much about that complexity. And so that's kind of an obstacle. But these days, I'm working on secure phone calls, and you don't have to know anything to make a secure phone call. You're not even aware of the key management. It just works.
Why is that? Because, for example, Microsoft's Skype does use an encryption which may or may not be broken at the NSA level, the National Security Agency level.
True. Skype does have some kind of encryption involved, but they don't tell you how it works. They don't publish a document with the protocol specification, and they also don't publish their source code. I do both. I publish a document detailing how the protocol works and how it manages cryptographic keys, every detail of how it works. Plus, I publish the source code, and that's what we do at Silent Circle. And that way, it's easier to get people to trust it. Not only trust that it doesn't have any backdoors, but also trust that it doesn't have any just plain bugs that would be accidental bugs that would, you know, weaken it in some way. Skype doesn't do any of that stuff.
Why is it that it's easier to do secure encrypted phone calls over the internet? Why is that more easy than doing encrypted emails over the internet?
Well, because when you encrypt emails, you have to be able to decrypt them later, perhaps much later, perhaps years later. And so you need persistent keys, keys that stick around for years. And that means you have to manage those keys. You have to have the certification that those keys belong to, the name that they appear to belong to. You need certificate authorities. You need trusted introducers and that sort of thing. But with phone calls are not persistent things. At the end of the call is finished. All the keys could be deleted at that point. So there's no need to create digital signatures. You can do other techniques to detect whether someone's wiretapping you.
Now, your Silent Circle is used by the UK government, the US government, for secure discussions. The question that I guess occurs is, okay, so you generate one-time keys when you're beginning the phone call, but how can you be sure that you're actually, that, A, that the phone call isn't tapped when it begins, and B, that the people on the either end of the conversation are who they say they are?
That's a great question. There is an attack that one could do against these kinds of systems. It's called a man-in-the-middle attack. And that's where you get a guy in the middle that impersonates each of the two parties to each other. And we use a different approach to detect a man-in-the-middle attack than other people use. Other people use digital signatures and certificate authorities, which are very complex ways of managing keys. And they're subject to catastrophic failures.
We have seen occasions where certificate authorities have been broken into by hackers.
Exactly.
Who've created their own certificates. I think
that's
it was
right.
Iran was one.
Iran,
of them.
Yes. There was an Iranian hacker a few years ago that broke into some certificate authority in the Netherlands, and stole the signing key for creating digital certificates for public keys. He used them to forge hundreds of certificates. For Gmail, for Yahoo, for the British government, the American government, for lots of companies. He then turned over those forged certificates to the Iranian regime, who then used them to perform man-in-the-middle attacks on thousands of Iranian dissidents and were able to read all their traffic. And so now you have a situation where there's untold numbers of Iranian dissidents in jail because of the catastrophic failure of a public key infrastructure. And I can't imagine how you could make a more convincing case than that. Even if we wrote fiction, we couldn't come up with a scenario that is more catastrophic than that one. So using a public key infrastructure is something that I went to great lengths to avoid. In fact, I designed this years before that catastrophic failure. I anticipated that something like that could happen. So we have other techniques to detect if there's a man-in-the-middle attack.
And because this is used by the UK and the US governments, and yet at the same time as open source, how are you able to persuade them to go along with that? Usually, you know, governments run away.
Well, one way to persuade them is what we did with PGP, which is to just have a really good product that stands up well to technical scrutiny. But that takes a long time. So we kind of took a shortcut this time because my business partner is a former US Navy SEAL. And so he's able to open a lot of doors that would take me years to open. And so now this means that we get attention much earlier from government agencies, intelligence agencies, special operations forces of the U.S. And Britain, and other governments as well. So we're getting into these kinds of markets much sooner than we did with PGP.
But even so, the sort of the tests and the investigations that these sorts of organizations do before they'll pass something as being usable are pretty time consuming. And
well, they are. But I've been working on this protocol for several years, and before Silent Circle was started. So it already has been technically reviewed by independent reviewers that we didn't pay any money to for years before Silent Circle. And I used only NIST-approved algorithms. Mm-hmm. So
that's the National Institute of Science and Technology.
That's right, in the U.S. They're responsible for all of the government standards for crypto. They're responsible for government standards for all kinds of things, like the weights mass of a kilogram or the length of a meter.
Mm-hmm. So where does Silent Circle go from here? Are you looking for everyone to be able to do this sort of thing, or are you very much aiming at the sort of the niche of the people who really need this to be secure?
Well, my intention was to aim at the niche first, the financial community, banking, Fortune 1000 companies, business travelers who go to China and want to make calls back home again without being wiretapped. The military is one such market, but you know, one of the things you have to overcome when you're selling crypto is how do you make people understand that they need it? Well, in this case, I don't have to work to make people understand that they need it. The markets that we're aiming for first are well aware that they need it.
So should we expect in a couple of years' time to find a Silent Circle app on app stores that, you know, if we are traveling to
right
China?
Right now you can.
We can right now.
Right now, if you go to the app store for the iPhone and download Silent Phone, you can have it running in a few minutes.
How much does it cost? I have to ask.
Well, the app is free, but it's a subscription service. It's $20 a month or $240 a year. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the British prices are, but they're
probably £240.
Yeah,
sort of the way that these.
Well,
are.
It's probably less than that. But we also have an app for the Android market. It's in the Google App Store. The app is free, but the subscription you have to pay for. We have voice over IP. We also have text messaging. It's called Silent Text. Silent Text can also send attachments. You can send, you know, 100 megabytes of attachments, for example, that are all encrypted. In fact, you can even send text that you can change your mind later and claw them back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you send a text message and you regret it, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. Don't text while drinking or something like that.
Right.
You can claw it back and make it disappear.
So how does this this world full of crypto look to you now? You know, given the perspective you had back in 91 when there really wasn't a lot of it about.
Well, it's easier to make it work now because we now have smartphones. We can carry in our pockets devices that are more powerful than desktop PCs were a few years ago. So that makes it a lot easier to do this kind of crypto.
So if you look sort of 5 years ahead or so, what do you expect to see in terms of the usage of cryptography, I don't know, in email, in phone calls, more broadly? And what are your aims for Silent Circle?
Well, I want to make it possible for you to whisper in someone's ear from 1,000 miles away, any two people to talk with privacy as if they were standing face to face. And right now, anybody can do that. They can download it now and go to town.
What do you think about the criticism that often come up from police sources and indeed from sort of security agencies and often from government ministers most loudly that if you give this sort of crypto to everyone, well, terrorists will use it. It makes it impossible to track the terrorists. What's your response to that?
Yes, criminals and terrorists will use this technology. And I wish we could figure out a way to not let them use the technology without also preventing everyone else from not using the technology. But I think that the benefits for everyone else using it outweigh the the downside of criminals using it.
Some government ministers would argue that what you need is to have backdoors, access to this crypto, ways that governments can, when they really need to, find out what is actually being said on these encrypted conversations. What would you respond to that?
If you put backdoors in a system like this, those backdoors can be exploited by attackers, by the Chinese government or foreign governments or organized crime. If we have the lives of Navy SEALs, for example, or special forces operating in Pakistan or Somalia or someplace like that, then if you put backdoors in, you're going to endanger the lives of our men and women in uniform that are operating under dangerous conditions. Is it worth the ability to wiretap everyone just so and endanger the lives of government agents that need it?
Phil Zimmerman, founder and president of Silent Circle and inventor of PGP, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Now it's time for a tech news roundup with Jason Phipps.
This week, Microsoft revealed a new Xbox console that not only integrates TV, internet and gaming, but also, they claim, will measure your heartbeats and recognize your voice. The company said its Xbox One will revolutionize its users' lifestyles by integrating the cloud, voice control, and gesture technology into a simple, intuitive machine. Microsoft's broader aim is to make the Xbox an all-in-one entertainment solution, funneling live TV, video on demand, and web chat, and allowing users to swiftly and easily move between all three. The integration with television was emphasized when Microsoft announced a deal with the NFL in the US to integrate coverage of the sport with game-like elements such as their fantasy football app, allowing viewers to manage their own fantasy football sides while watching the real thing in action. Also, it was announced by Microsoft that Steven Spielberg will be producing a TV series based on the best-selling Halo games, exclusively available on Xbox One. It's another sign that Microsoft sees itself as a content maker as well as a platform provider. For Keith Stewart's full coverage of the launch in text and video form, go to our game site at guardian.co.uk/tech. This week, a number of tech companies came under fire for their tax arrangements. The Guardian reported the allegations that Apple uses a, quote, highly questionable web of offshore entities to avoid paying billions in US income taxes, according to a US Senate committee. The complex arrangement includes three subsidiaries based ostensibly in Ireland. Apple released their CEO Tim Cook's statement to the committee before the scheduled meeting, and in it, he robustly defended the company, denying charges that the company uses tax gimmicks and pointing out that the company has created 600,000 jobs in the US and paid $6 billion in taxes to the US Treasury in 2012. Cook also defends the Irish subsidiaries, which he says now employ more than 4,000 people. He said, quote, Apple complies fully with both the laws and the spirit of the laws, and Apple pays all its required taxes, both in this country and abroad. Announced this week, financier George Soros has led a $50 million investment in the fibre optic company Hyperoptic, which lays high-speed lines direct to UK homes. The funding from the Soros investment vehicle Quantum Strategic Partners will help Hyperoptic reach its target of 500,000 homes within the next 5 years. Its, quote, hyper-fast lines transmit information at 1 gigabyte per second, which is more than 80 times the UK broadband average of 12 megabytes per second. And the company has already reached 20,000 homes in London. While BT is installing fibre to street cabinets across the country, it relies on copper from the cabinet to the home, which can reduce speeds. Fewer than 1% of UK premises are directly plugged into fibre lines, according to the Fibre to the Home Council Europe, compared with 50% in Japan and 10% in the United States. And finally, a motorist is being investigated by police after she boasted on Twitter that she had knocked a cyclist off his bike. Emma Way tweeted this week, "Definitely knocked a cyclist off his bike earlier. I have right of way. He doesn't even pay road tax. Hashtag bloody cyclists." Her post prompted outrage among users of the social network, who alerted police to it. Norwich Police contacted Way via Twitter, suggesting that she direct message them as soon as possible. Norfolk Police subsequently said they were in touch with both Way and the cyclist involved, Tom Hockley, and were making further inquiries. Hockley, a 29-year-old freelance chef from Norwich, later said that he had not intended on reporting the incident until he read the comment on Twitter. For all these stories and so much more, visit guardian.co.uk/technology.
In another email from America, our latter-day Alistair Cook, Alex Kotowski, writes an open letter to Yahoo. The media giant, or is it a technology giant, announced this week that it's buying the social blogging site Tumblr for a cool $1.1 billion. Alex wonders what impact this might have on Tumblr, which has for the past few years offered a place for anonymity and expression.
Dear Yahoo, I understand you've bought Tumblr for rather a lot of money. Congratulations to everyone involved. I trust it will be a loving, long-term relationship. In fact, that's exactly what I'm writing to you about. Trust. Because you've not just bought an online blogging service. You've bought an identity playground. One of the few places in the mainstream web where people can go and without fear of being watched or asked for their real identity or checked for their real identity by people in their social networks can express themselves fully and anonymously. And trust that whatever they put online won't come back to bite them. Unless, of course, they specifically ask. I know, it seems ridiculous that a place where anonymous millions who post thoughts, photos, videos, quotes, audio, who reblog other anonymous people's thoughts, photos, videos, quotes, audio, and who like other anonymous people's thoughts, photos, videos, quotes, audio could be so important. But I want to put it in the context of the online ecosystem as it stands now. The web is currently dominated by online places where we have to say exactly who we are. In return, we get incredible services, personalized services, services that give us exactly what we want and need because they know us sometimes better than ourselves. They do this magical feat with smoke and mirrors fed by a single thing, a single identity. Most mainstream social networks, search engines, online shopping arcades want to know exactly who we are offline, and that's been an important part of the growth of the web. Web services that validate who we are and who we're talking to have lowered the barrier to entry so much so that people who we never thought would have gone online are now perfectly happy to publish information about themselves and their friends to a degree that it's caused countless headlines wailing about the demise of privacy. And then Tumblr came along. And Tumblr gave us our anonymity back for the first time in a long time, as the anonymity of the web has been imperceptibly whittled away. Why is this important, Yahoo? Well, because it's nice to be able to express oneself freely and openly and not feel like it's going to come back and bite you. Unless, of course, you ask. Allow me to reminisce for a moment about the way things were. Back in the first decade of the web, when researchers like Sherry Turkle, John Barg, and Caitlin McKenna were writing about what people were doing online, there was a lot of buzz about how the communication medium was an important place for people to express different aspects of themselves. Things that might otherwise be difficult to talk about with friends or family offline because they may seem too out of the ordinary. These aspects of the self could appear to the outsider to be totally innocuous, but I promise you, to the person who couldn't talk to friends or family about them, they were hugely important for their psychological feelings of self-worth and self-esteem. The online world at the time was celebrated as an identity laboratory, a place where people could try on a self like a new pair of trousers and see what happened. Did it fit? Was it uncomfortable? Did the people in the online community laugh? Or did they think it suited you? And based on that reaction, so the theory goes, you slowly introduced the new aspect of the self into the offline world, and you became a more self-actualized person, but for much cheaper than therapy. But this is kind of the problem with the web. People thought it was populated by the wounded or the incomplete. It's where people with issues went, remember? It's where the socially inept disappeared to because it was the only place they could find their people. It's not like that anymore, thanks to Facebook. But also thanks to systems like Facebook and the pachydermal mind of Google, our ability to try on new aspects of ourselves for the purpose of large or small reinvention has slowly eroded. But psychologically speaking, reinvention is essential for people across the life spectrum, but mostly for kids who are going through all kinds of chaotic social and personal growths, and they need to feel that they can press Ctrl-Alt-Delete on something they put out there in case it doesn't fit. After all, discarding identities is just as important as putting them on. Now, it's timely that you, Yahoo, have announced your relationship with Tumblr, because I've only just become aware of Tumblr's role in all of this psychosocial development stuff. I personally have many Tumblogs, some to do with my book projects, others to do with independent projects, and some to do with things that have absolutely no relation to who I am in either of those worlds. I naturally gravitated to Tumblr's simple service and didn't really think about how it allowed me to shard myself across the web in ways that aren't associated with a Facebook account or a regular email address or anything trackable by Google. I am not hiding anything, far from it, but I trust the system will allow me to play with these little bits of me without consequence and without selling me to the highest bidder. I didn't realize just how important that's become in general until I got an email from a high school student from Auckland, New Zealand. She said she's working on a student documentary about anonymity on the web, particularly how it's used on websites like Tumblr. Previously, I'd assumed the last bastions of anonymity online were places like 4chan, where no one needs to know your name and all contributions are totally ephemeral and unarchived. But you know what? The kids, observed by parents, teachers, Facebook, and Google, have found another place to go, once again asserting the freedom of expression that we oldies had in the early days of the web. And now, Yahoo, yourself a veteran of the online space, you've plunked down a pretty penny for it. And so I implore you, please let it be. And please, please, really let it be. Don't track us, trace us, or try to document us. Don't shut these voices down. We, all of us, are psychologically unbaked. It's the human condition. We need to be able to operate elsewhere, and the self-expression and documentation that the web allows is unprecedented for that kind of insight. We trust the system to let us be who we are. And now, we have to trust you. Lots of love, Alex.
Thanks to Alex Kotowski there. And that's all we have for you this week. Remember, to keep up to speed with tech news day or night, just go to guardian.co.uk/technology, and you can see all of the day's stories by adding /all to the URL. But from me, Charles Arthur, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye for now.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.